This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It has been a week. Ooh. Yeah. You know, we're making progress. I might have mentioned last week that we're working on something called service increment. Lots of complicated rules, lots of exceptions that are just manual exceptions, and we've got it down to a list. There's 235 exceptions that need to be looked at, and every afternoon we're getting together and we're just slogging through them. So I think we're up in the 60s at this point. We're just slogging through. And every once in a while, we hit something. And it's just this minor little thing. But, it has to be investigated. You just have to see what's going on there to tell if it's okay and you can do it manually once. Or if you specifically have to watch for something. I mean, it's fascinating. It really, really is fascinating. But that's okay. One step at a time. We're getting there. And the benefit eventually will be to get some algorithms working on this stuff and get to a canonical authoritative list so this never has to be done again. But getting there, it's a slog. I mean, we're just slogging through. We'll get there. The writing seems to be going fine. I have a general idea of where I'm going on this next book, and I think it's going to be fine. There's several details. I've got these little kind of vague images of where I want to be and how I want things to factor together because it'll be amusing or interesting or whatever. And I'm not sure where those pieces all go yet. But I've been in this situation before, and it's really a question of, I've got this sense that it's over that hill, and so you just set your face towards it and keep moving. And then it works out. I mean, it's just amazing. So it's going to be interesting. I did have kind of a little bit of a crisis this last week because I had been planning since the beginning that a particular line out of the poem, which is the third line of the second stanza, something like the second coming. Well, second stanza starts, surely some revelation is at hand, surely the second coming is at hand. And then the third line is the second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. And I had in my brain, that was supposed to hit at book 11, and I had in my brain what that was supposed to be since the beginning. And now that I'm on book 10, I'm looking at it going, nope. So then I was like, because it was a major plot development. But, I was thinking about it, and then bang, I got it. It's like, oh, I could do that, and then I could move forward that major plot development to the end of the second opus, book 16. That'll work. It'll be great. And so, yeah, I'm gonna do that. But it was just really interesting that one actually, it didn't really shake me, but it was like, rats, because I've been running a certain timeline based on getting to a certain year on book 11. And then I was thinking, how am I going to work this out? And then I got it this week. So, it's step at a time. You're just moving forward. Anyways, all is well with the family. We're good. All is well at work. All is well with the writing. We're good. Okay. I had talked couple of months ago, I think, on my whole current understanding of gender relationships, and I've been mentioning things here and there on that, but I've got kind of a whole different kind of thing I've been chatting with my friends about these last couple of weeks. And I had a conversation with my daughter about this actually last Saturday when we went for a walk. And I really rely on Liz because I've told her over and over, you know, sweetie, I can kind of guess and I can kind of extrapolate, but at the end of the day, I'm a guy, and that means it's never gonna quite be right. So I bounce things off her a lot just to try to get her opinion. I mean, she's probably one of the only women that I can really talk in depth to about some of these things. And so I value her opinion, but I recognize that it is only her opinion and her experience. And her experience, I think, is not average and not in general. And so there's a little bit of skew there, but that's okay. I mean, we are all on a continuum as human beings. And when my daughter told me, you have to understand that high school is a little different for me because when I was in high school, I didn't think of myself as a woman. I thought of myself as smart. And the more I push into trying to think through gender relationships and how, in general, on average, men and women are pushed in certain directions, both societally and also by the flesh within them, the more I can understand that that kind of an attitude in high school was very different. I didn't think of myself as a woman. I thought of myself as smart. And how Lizzie got there, I mean, I'd love to take some credit for it, but, you know, every person is an individual. I always, in Lizzie growing up, played much more to her strengths and her intelligence and in challenging her intelligence in, you know, giving her the opportunity to be a thinker than I did cooing over the fact she was cute. But, you know. So anyways, I've been thinking more about that whole thing, and I don't really have any notes, and I was thinking, oh, you better go back and figure out what of this you actually talked about, because, you know, I didn't want to go over some stuff, but I'm pretty sure I haven't talked about this, and if I have, well, you know, this is a waste of a podcast, but that's all right. And I didn't necessarily want to use notes because I'm just got a lot of these things rolling around in my brain. And I may think about this differently tomorrow. But, you know, if my past experiences and ruminating on these things is any indication, I probably won't. I'll probably just build from there. So I think the last time that I talked about gender relationships in full was really talking about it from the standpoint of quote-unquote sex drive, talking from a standpoint of the basic differences towards men and women, that there is a continuum, lust and fear. Women tend to drift towards fear. Men tend to drift towards lust. That's not to say that there are not men who fear or are not women who lust. But there's tendencies. And if we were going to quantify these tendencies based in large part on some of the things that I've heard Jordan Peterson say, and I have mentioned this in the past, that, for instance, if you get 100 people together, and 50 men, 50 women, and you randomly pick a woman, you randomly pick a man, that the chances are, if you say the man is going to be more aggressive, that's you're going to be right 60% of the time. You're going to be right 40% of the time if you say a woman is the aggressor. So what that demonstrates is there's not that much difference at the mean and the center. But when you get to the edges, things get more exaggerated. So I have said that before. So there's that foundational piece. And there's also, we've talked about the fact that there's no such thing really as sex drive. It's really reproductive drive. And at that point, when I was talking about it, I was talking about the fact that men obviously can participate in reproductive rituals every single day. And so they think about sex a lot under normal circumstances. Whereas women can only get fertile once a month. And so there's obviously an immediate skew right there. But I don't think that's quite right. While I did say, but then of course, you know, they get pregnant and then ta-da-ta-da-ta-da, you know, there's no need for a sex drive or reproductive drive at that point. But I think there's more to it than that now, and this may just seem obvious, but it was interesting enough to me that I thought, well, I'm just going to put this down. Because when I say there's no such thing as sex drive, that there is only reproductive drive, I should have quantified that better, and I should have said there's no such thing as sex drive, there is only reproductive drives, plural, and they manifest themselves in two different ways. So sorry if I've said this already, but you have an insemination drive in a man, and that insemination drive, like we said, can happen every day. And that insemination drive is transient. So for men, the experience of a reproductive ritual is that there's an urgency that builds over time. And then there is the carrying out of the ritual, however that's done. And instantaneously, it's like a switch goes off. Flip, done. And the guy's out rooting in the kitchen for food. Done. There's no other thoughts beyond the event. Done. The reproductive drive in women isn't just when she's fertile, although there is a spike in testosterone levels when she is fertile to make her more aggressive if she's not on the pill, which has convinced her body that she's pregnant. So, but beyond that, the reproductive drive is for incubation. And that means the reproductive drive stretches for 9 months, at least. And in fact, beyond that 9 months is the whole lactation cycle, where this child cannot survive on its own without something similar to mother's milk to feed on, because its digestive system is not formed up yet, cannot handle solid food. So this incubation drive to create a child is far more than just something that happens every day. One moment, getting my mail. And in fact, it stretches over multiple months. Even if you don't count lactation, it's still going to be 6 weeks approximately before a woman can get pregnant again. Wow, lots of packages today. But this one is not mine, that's my beloved's. And this one is mine. There you go. Okay. So that's a really important factor to realize that, because again, women are operating on a scale that is completely foreign to men in terms of reproductive rituals. I mean, the scale that men are working on is minutes. It's very small. Whereas the scale that women are working on is months, potentially a year to satisfy this reproductive drive. And in fact, I would contend that the reproductive drives, you know, women have been, actually, I'm going to roll down the windows here a minute, and I'm going to, it's such a beautiful day. I'm going to roll down the windows and keep talking. In fact, it's just a little bit on the cool side, but it's just such a beautiful day. I'll let it go. So I would contend that we are wrong-headed. Oh, you know, hang on. hang on a minute. Because it seems like I did something like this before and the wind was blowing a little bit and it was blowing on the mics, and so we don't want that. But at least I'll get the open air cool out the other side of the car. I would contend that... sorry. Let me roll down the back window on the passenger side as well. I would contend that we are wrong-headed now when we classify women as having a low sex drive, because that's a whole misnomer, since it's not really a sex drive, it's a reproductive drive. And then it's a misnomer, it's not only a misnomer, it's wrong-headed, because we are evaluating women's drive based on something that is fundamentally more primitive in men than that drive is in women, because in women it is a long, extended drive, and in fact it takes a whole bunch more determination, it takes a whole bunch more focus. And my daughter beat me to the punchline on this when I was talking to her about it, and she kind of nodded. She said, and so women's reproductive drive is just as strong as men is. I said, right, but it exists at a different scale. And I would contend that women's reproductive drive is even stronger than men when you take all the factors into consideration. So this grunting drive, this grunting, intermittent, short-term drive that men have to inseminate things really is very simplistic when you compare it to the mechanics of what's happening inside a woman on average in general. Granted, there are some women who have no desire to have children. My wife's best friend from college, no desire to have children. Zip. Never had it. Maybe that had something to do with the abuse that she suffered as a child. Maybe not. I don't know. But she just said, no, I've just never been interested in having children. So obviously there's a lot of variance. Okay, so let's talk about then why I think the drive in women is just as strong, if not stronger, than men. It just exists on different timescales. And that is, first of all, with men, obviously, the reproductive drive is coupled with pleasure. So, you know, men get a dopamine hit every time they participate in the ritual of reproduction. I mean, they orgasm, they get a dopamine hit. And that kind of contributes and can, you know, easily, if allowed, cause men to become addicted, you know, through the use of pornography, bad idea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For women, the fact of the matter is that women have two discrete subsystems, as opposed to men, where we just have one integrated subsystem. Women have two discrete subsystems. And we've mentioned in the past that for many women, over half, it simply isn't possible for them to orgasm through straight intercourse, through the insemination ritual. So these subsystems are disconnected. They happen to be located in similar area, in a similar area in the body, but they are actually two disconnected subsystems. One can function completely separate from the other. A woman can get inseminated without any pleasure at all. A woman can have pleasure without having anything to do with reproduction. What's gets more and more interesting when you look at it in this model is that there is a critical path that is required of women in order to perform their reproductive rituals. The critical path, let's say, for instance, that this is correct. There's this tremendous drive in women to have children. Maybe it doesn't exist at the kind of hot intensity that a man's drive does, but that's because a man's drive is transient. And, Just blocking spam on my phone. That's because a man's drive is transient. It's you know, very intense, but then done. And honestly, I just lost my thought, but that's okay. I'll get back to it. Honestly, when we look around us in our society, in terms of using one of the reproductive drives as an engine in society, there's no question that the insemination drive is used far more often than the incubation drive. You do see some advertisements where pregnant women are selling things, but the vast majority of motivational elements that are used from the reproductive drives to drive society forward are going to be from the insemination side. I mean, not to be crude, but when you look at fashion, what is fashion? At its basest, at its most generalized feature, fashion is baby feeders and insemination ports. I mean, that's it. And when you look around at all the different things that are used to sell products, it's either pretty girl to get the attention of men, or it's pretty girl to make women feel like if they don't look like that, they're not going to be able to hold on to a man or to get a man, because this brings us back to what we were just talking about, critical path. So the thing about a woman's reproductive drive is there is a critical path that at present, maybe not in the future, but at present, she has to participate in the insemination drive of men. But the reverse is not true. So this is also a big difference. So, yeah, men might want to inseminate something, but at the end of the day, you know, you get pretty close. You get pretty close, even without that. So, you know, while there are some men that are thinking, man, I got to inseminate something so I can make a baby, they're just thinking, no, I just want to do this so I get my little dopamine pop. And I think one of the things that's interesting about that configuration, and not assigning any value to it, I just say this is interesting, is there is a certain psychic dissonance I think that creates. Because women's focus on average in general, this is all in average in general, on average, in it, women's focus at a deep core level of their being to have children is predicated on the fact that they have to get a man involved, and in their bones, they know what men are attracted to, because they not only see it in society, they also feel it. They also know when they're getting more looks from men. They also, you know, they learn over time. And there's been a lot of studies done as to what, you know, what men find quote unquote attractive. You know, 75% hip to waist ratio, which is really interesting because it has nothing to do with weight. It is the hip to waist ratio that's important. Symmetrical faces, you know, shiny hair, indicator of health. I mean, these are all really basic lizard brain or hind brain, whatever you want to call it. These are maps that are built in to that basic reproductive ritual and that programming. And women understand that. They understand that. And they understand that that's part of it. But their focus is really more towards children. And that process of having a child is not filled with pleasure. So this is another huge difference. They have a pleasure subsystem that happens to be located in the same spot. But even before they're pregnant, obviously, 2 weeks out of the month or so, there is pains and aches for the most part in general. There's blood. Then when they get pregnant, now you're actually growing a human being inside you, which is an astonishing thing. And there's discomfort and there's pain and there's morning sickness. And then there's the birth. And I've jokingly, you know, which is not really jokingly, told my buddies and my daughter along the way these last couple of weeks, you know, if men had to go through all of that and on their reproductive side of the equation, they'd go, forget this. The human race would die out because, whoo. So there's all of that, but how does that then work out in practical ways? And what is really happening under the surface for all of this? Jordan Peterson, I was thinking about it in one way, and then Jordan Peterson said something again when I was listening to one of the podcasts that had him on it that he had said before that I really hadn't mapped in yet. But what he had said was that he is not sure if women's psyches, in general, on average, are ideally suited for the woman's success. He said they may be suited, in fact, for the success of a woman and her young child. Now, that's an interesting idea. And I think there's a lot of things that map into that. Because one of the things that you see in women, according to Jordan Peterson, you know, he talks about the aggressive thing where it's 60-40. The flip side of that is agreeableness. And then another component of that is neuroticism. So he said, I think it's basically on the 60-40 scale again, that in general, women suffer more from neurotic elements, depression, anxiety, again, on the fear scale, as opposed to on the lust scale. And it's interesting because these differences show up at puberty, which I think I mentioned at one point. You know, I've been reading articles and they try to explain all around it. Well, that's because society is expecting different. And my thing is, you know, or it's puberty. Because there is something to be said that boys get more aggressive when they go through puberty and they have more testosterone roaring through their systems. And potentially women become more agreeable and slightly more neurotic when they go through puberty and they have more female hormones like estrogen roaring through their systems. And it's of interest that when men wish to transition to become women and they're put on testosterone blockers and then they're also put on estrogen therapy, they frequently relate that they feel emotional all the time. and there hasn't been any changes necessarily to their brain. So it doesn't have anything to do with brain, but it has to do with the chemicals and the wash of chemicals that are being produced by the reproductive systems. So that's all interesting. But getting back to this idea that women may be ideally suited not for their own benefit, but for the benefit of their young children. Because this reproductive incubation drive is very difficult. It's taxing. It's an amazing miracle. And if women didn't have some of the constitutions that they have, agreeableness, you know, higher neuroticism, more aware of threat, you know, perhaps the human race would not survive and thrive as it has. And so the whole idea of motherhood, which is a core identity for women, necessarily puts a heavier emotional load on women than it does for men, because they have to be able to respond under that load with dedication, you know, with love, with welcoming, with commitment, or those babies aren't going to survive. And when you put it in that context, I think it becomes more useful then to realize that a young woman who is in her reproductive prime doesn't just represent herself, she represents all her unborn children. And when she is moving through life, making decisions, assessing threats, when she is looking to survive this life and to thrive, it's not just her she's thinking about. She's thinking about herself. And as Candace Owens made an offhand comment that I heard just yesterday, yes, I want to get married someday. Yes, I want to have children, but, you know, I think about my someday children. She called them my someday children. There is this awareness of being in this mode. And I think this points back to one of the reasons that the princess archetype is so strong. This princess icon is so strong and resonates so deeply with women, because what is the classic princess? What is her role? Her job is to bear children. She is protected. She is honored. And the things she is protected for and honored for are not her skill set. She is protected and honored for her beauty, because her beauty gets her a suitor, and the suitor then gets her children. So this is a big deal. So when a woman is making a decision of how threatening is this, it's, you know, she's carrying this generational mental load. And I think that has to be factored in. Now, okay, and I'm way over on time, so I got to move on this. This is all just really interesting to me. So then when you see the push, when you see the push of the flesh underneath this, then what does it push? It's going on the man's side to push aggressiveness and push lust, because that plays right into the very natural reproductive drives that he has. And on the woman's side of it, it's going to push that anxiety and to push that danger and to push that need to control the environment and to create a suitable environment, to push the focus, narrow it down onto those future children, you know, that reproduction, that legacy there. And in the process of doing that, men just become bit players. And actually, men become bit players to women, because we've talked about this before, because they are the guard. They are the one that's going to provide the seed, but that's just a very small part of the whole process in women's mind, accurately so. But then they are also going to provide the protection when the woman is having her children and the provision. And, you know, okay, that's the kind of classic model. So women, in that way, we've talked about this, dehumanize men, and then men, it's obvious that men dehumanize women as just, you know, can I have sex with it? So all of that's very interesting. And like I said, I haven't worked my way all the way through all those pieces, but there's enough there. I thought, well, you know, we should talk about this. And just a second, because there was one other thing I was going to... I don't know what it is. Anyway, I'll get it another time. What was funny about all this is I was thinking about doing this, and I was thinking, oh, do I really want to talk about this yet or this? And then I was driving to work today, and I've been listening on and off to a YouTuber who's new called Georgia Free. She's young, blonde, you know, in her 20s. Height of her value in the reproductive marketplace. She will admit that point blank when she talks about it. I mean, very attractive young lady. But she's trying to think her way through that and trying to figure out what's going on inside her and why, you know, this. Well, I came across one of her talks called Thoughts on Hypergamy. And we've talked about hypergamy, how that men generally marry across and down the social strata, because all they need is someone to inseminate, and then they're off to other things. And that women tend to go across and up. And you can easily relate hypergamy to this idea of women having this reproductive drive that's about incubation, lactation, but then it's also about the future children. It's also about that legacy and inheritance that a woman creates for herself. And she started talking through this hypergamy and admitted that she has always practiced hypergamy. She said, you know, that she has always judged men quickly on their social status, on, you know, how much money they had, how interesting they were, what they look like, because then she would either be attracted or not attracted to them. And she remembers doing that ever since she was six. And I mean, she's just brutally honest. She said, I feel like a gold digger and I feel shallow when I'm saying this. She said, but this is just something I've practiced all my life. I didn't even know there was a term for it. And she said, you know, when she looks back on her life experience of why she accepted one man's proposal and rejected another, she said it's because of that perception and superiority of status that can be multiple things. But it always came down to he needed to be in the upper echelon. He needed to be an alpha male. And she goes on and talks about the fact that women, obviously, for their sons, are going to be sensitive to a woman who's a gold digger and not want him to pursue that. But for their daughters, will want to encourage, just like fathers will for their daughter, want him to encourage her to find someone above the social state, someone who has a lot of money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what was interesting is that she gets into this, and she said she comes down to this, that she was saying when women had children in the past, you know, there could be the potential for crisis, especially back in the day when many of the problems were related to just protection from the environment. So why would a woman be attracted to anything less, knowing that being with someone who couldn't protect her would jeopardize not just her safety, but the safety of her own children? Because again, there is this factoring. And she goes on to say, you know, hypergamy isn't going to work so well now because, you know, women have their own, are earning their own money, and how that, you know, the police are available at a push of a button. But I think she's wrong on that point. Women are still going to do hypergamy now because hypergamy is a after effect of this deeply ingrained identity of mother that says, not only do I have to be protected, but my future children are going to be protected, and I can dial 911, but it may be 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, an hour, depending on where you live, how far out in the country, before the police get there. And therefore, it's better to have someone protecting you. So I listened to this, and I'm like, and there it is. This is everything I've been talking about, because in general, I mean, she even talked about this drive that women have to find the man of the highest social status. She said it's really just a hindbrain thing. That's the way her terminology, that's a hindbrain thing. Just like in men, wanting to inseminate women is a hindbrain thing. It's not something you have direct control over. The fact of the matter is that we are creatures of free will, and I believe we have the capability to live in a way to where we're not completely subject to our flesh. And so then that kind of brings up the other thing I was just thinking of a few minutes ago. Okay, so now what do we do? Because we have these natural systems that are needed. Oh, one of the interesting things she said was, she said, so what am I going to do in terms of this hypergamy? How am I going to handle this? She said, because honestly, she said, I am a woman of high value when it comes to, you know, the current setups. You know, and it's interesting because as she's doing the video, you know, she's wearing a little lower cut top and she has positioned the camera just so that you can see the beginning of cleavage. Why? Because she's displaying that she has nice baby feeders, because it's reproductive drive. Anyways, so she was talking about, okay, so what do I do in this situation? How do I deal with this, when the fact is I know this about myself now, and I look around and I thought at first that I would only marry someone who's a couple of years older than me. But when I look at the men who are in my time frame, you know, a lot of them are just interested in just inseminating something. They don't, not really interested in commitment, settling down. So she said one of the things that she has done then is expanded her time frame. So she won't necessarily just date men who are a couple of years older. She's going to go potentially 10 years. Maybe she even said 12 years. She said because those men are more ready to settle down. Those men are more ready to be the protector. Those men have more resources for her. And it's just out of those reproductive drives. Now. So you've got the reproductive drives that serve a purpose, that are designed for some specific things that are important. All right. And then you have the flesh on top of that, pushing that to extremes. Now then, how do we keep ourselves from being just driven by that? Well, I've talked in the past about what men can do. Because the fact of the matter is that our reproductive drive is transient. And the switch flips in our brain. Boom. You know, after we've gone through our little ritual. Bam, done, moving on. And so that actually makes it easier for men, again, because you can initiate that ritual all by your little lonesome. You're not depending on someone else. and so then you can take care of it. And it's like, hey, moving on to other things, you know. So that's great. But for women then, where does this settle in? How does a woman deal with this constant? One moment. This is my wife and she's going away this weekend. I'm going to pause. I'll be right. Okay. Back. Got choir retreat this weekend, my wife does, and she had done a bunch of arrangements for the choir, and then she couldn't open them at church, and so she needed them converted to PDFs. Anyways, okay, so just real quick, and I'm so long. So first of all, what can be a strategy? Because I don't believe that Jesus and God designed a world where women are forced to be in anxiety for the more major portions of their lives without any kind of escape. So where men have a mechanism where they can lower the influence of the reproductive drive, then what are the mechanisms that might be available to women? And I think those mechanisms are different. They are not pleasure related, although they might be. That piece of it I don't know yet, but it is an intriguing possibility that perhaps a woman's pleasure subsystem is so much more comprehensive than a man that if she's willing to use that pleasure subsystem, that it can actually help alleviate some of this anxiety. So maybe that's there, but I think something that is a direct fortification against the anxiety is to address the immediacy of the feeling of dependence, because that feeling of dependence that I need something out there or I'm not going to be able to accomplish this deep drive within me creates psychic dissonance. And it creates anxiety. And this is the reason that it creates anxiety, as far as I can see, is that women have to end up pretending they are something that instinctively know they aren't. So they have to dress in certain ways, they have to act in certain ways, they have to flirt, they have to be attractive, all those kind of things, when they'd really just rather be home in their sweats on the couch, you know, eating and watching TV and relaxing. But then they have to doll themselves all up because they need this one critical component. They know they're giving a certain impression of themselves when in fact they're not that. And they know that the reckoning day is going to come, you know, so they get married. Then all of a sudden, you know, they're aren't trying nearly as hard because they've had a couple of babies. And so there's a psychic. We saw this in Las Vegas. I may have mentioned this already. We're in Las Vegas and, you know, at night, the people come out that are all dressed up to take photos with. So you got these little gals and they're all dressed up in their showgirl outfits. And some of them have nothing more than pasties and a thong on besides all the flowers and the feathers and all that kind of stuff. And so they're just walking down, you know, jiggling around, and they don't approach the men per se because they know the women would slap them down. They always find a woman in the couple. Hey, sweetie, come on over, take a picture with us. You know, so I mean, because this woman is now between all these showgirls and she's, you know, feeling uncomfortable because there is all of this insemination ritual attraction happening around her. And the guy is staring at the women. So, and he's getting, you know, under normal circumstances, a little hot and bothered. And of course, in that case, then he's going to tip better and blah, 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 blah. And these women are mostly all smiles and frills and great, except when you walk by them and they're in a little huddle and they're talking and they are unhappy. I mean, there's like, ar-ar-ar. And the other example I had of this was as just some customers, we were moving through, I don't know if I mentioned this already, we were moving through some of the shops and I looked over to the side and there was a man and woman in there. They were obviously connected. I would suspect boyfriend and girlfriend because she's probably not going to dress like that way after she's married. And basically all she has on is a bra and then like boy shorts and by lingerie boy shorts, not shorts that boys would wear. But at the same time, she's got her arms folded over her waist. She is obviously uncomfortable. Because she's in this psychic dissonance of she has to keep him interested because she thinks he's a person of value. She knows what he wants to see. And if she dresses like that, he stays interested. But now she's out in public and she's very uncomfortable because this is not who she is. And she doesn't necessarily want to encourage that from everyone. She just wants to encourage it from her boyfriend. But she knows her boyfriend kind of gets a little charge over the fact that he can say, yeah, look at this fabulous woman I'm connected to. So, I mean, there's dissonance. So what do you do to address that? Is there any possibility? And the only possibility that I've found so far that I think makes sense is for the woman to get stronger or for the woman to get faster or more capable. My daughter Lizzie said, yeah, we're guns. That's true. But you don't want to play at guns at all, just like you don't want to play at the rest of it. I mean, you have to make the mental ascent and you have to practice that if you're going to carry a gun and someone's going to attack you, you have to go over it in your mind to the place that you are going to kill them. You're going to shoot for center mass. You're not going to fool around. And I think you have to have a practice of firing guns and potentially a practice of firing guns at live targets, not human beings, But getting used to that, getting over that hesitation to kill something. Because if you don't have that, if you're carrying around a gun and you're not ready to use it, it will just go bad. Because you'll freeze and then your attacker will have a gun as well. So I think things like CrossFit could be very beneficial. Seems to be from what I've seen. Because the woman gets stronger, she feels more capable. Beyond that, though, really martial arts, I think, is a big thing. Because then you're not relying on any kind of outside tool. You're taking responsibility to defend yourself. You're taking responsibility and you're going through the practice of understanding how to fight. You know, we always talk about fight or flight, but it's not really fight or flight. It's fight or flight for men. But for women, it's often freeze. Just don't do anything. And I've found myself in situations before where I basically froze. So it's fight or flight or freeze. And to get over that freeze, you've got to be play acting, being attacked, so that, you know, when it happens, it just spins up and goes. And I think women who take the time to invest in that, either in strength or in fighting ability or in the wielding of weapons in high stress situations, I think that seems like that would help. And maybe it would also help if the women really did practice and exercise self-pleasuring, because, you know, maybe that is a help as well. Wow, this has been like completely unchristian in our normal things, hasn't it? And it's so long. Have I been talking for an hour? I'm sorry. I'm so sorry for this for going for so long. Maybe you just listen to it in pieces. But this is all just really fascinating because it's completely different than what I grew up as. I mean, everything, there was only one definition and it was all male fantasy. And that was the only thing that drove the world. And there's far more than that going on. And I think men will never really understand women until they factor in some of these pieces. And I don't think women can really understand men until they understand how different the average male's experience is when he moves through life, including matters reproductive. That's went so long today. Sorry, but I have finally made it home.